Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I want to get your reactions to open the show to President Trump's United 93 Memorial Ceremony speech. I thought it was quite a remarkable 15-minute review of the events of that day and the implications of that day and the heroism of the heroes of that day. Here's President Trump setting the scene. What a pack of four brave pack from the 40 brave patriots on that flight did on 9/11/2001.
On September 11th, 2001, a band of brave patriots turned the tide on our nation's enemies and joined the immortal ranks of American heroes. At this memorial on this sacred earth, in the field beyond this wall, and in the skies above our heads, we remember the moment when America fought back.
It was his finest moment. I mean, he seemed presidential. He seemed genuinely saddened by the events that took place 17 years ago. And I love the fact that, well, you could play your sound first, but later on in the speech, he went through what happened and he named their names while after pointing to the family members. We are here because your loved ones are heroes.
17 years ago, your loved ones were among the 40 of Flight 93, the 40 passengers and crew members on board the 8 a.m. United Airlines flight from Newark to San Francisco. They were men and women from every background. They were young people returning from visiting family, moms and dads on business trips, and friends going and coming from birthdays and weddings. They boarded the plane as strangers, and they entered eternity, linked forever, as true heroes.
Boarded the plane as strangers and entered eternity, linked together as heroes.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, it was a beautiful turn of a phrase. And I agree with you that he made his that speech his own. And you know, and it frankly calls into question the demonization of Trump. And I tweeted out in response to that after watching that speech. So love him, hate him, or somewhere in between, which is more plausible? That Trump is a plotting tyrant with the theatrical talent of Sir Laurence Olivier, because that would have been needed right, if it wasn't genuine to pull off that speech the way that he did. Or is it more plausible that Trump is a transactional cad who loves this country and is trying to do right by her? So a guy with a lot of flaws who's lived a colorful and sometimes dishonorable life. I think we've all had our moments of dishonor. His more pronounced than many. But which is it? Which is really Trump? Trump is a plotting authoritarian.
Dictator.
That's what's really going on here. That's what this administration, this president is really about. Is that plausible? He can give that speech in that way. And a speech doesn't change everything. A speech, you know, we had a previous president who was good at reading from a teleprompter, too. But connect Trump's behavior and the delivery of that speech and tell me again which is more plausible. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-360-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
And he went on to paint this picture of what they went through and how they worked together to really stop other Americans from being killed by terrorists.
Sandy Bradshaw, a flight attendant, called her husband and told him they were in the back of the plane preparing hot water to throw onto the hijackers. Passenger Jeremy Glick explained the plan to his wife and said, "Stay on the line, I'll be back." The passengers and crew members came together, took a vote, and they decided to act. At that moment, they took their fate and America's fate back into their own hands. In the last 20 minutes, many placed their final calls home, whispering those eternal words, "I love you."
And I like him recounting the individual names and mm-hmm. the individual accounts of what happened that day. Mike Rowe offered another one. You know, Mike Rowe from Dirty Jobs and
yeah.
Discovery. Mike Rowe offered another one of Tom Burnett. He reposted the transcript of Tom Burnett's call to his wife, Dina, transcripts of the calls. Because there was a few of them, and they're rather remarkable.
Are you going to make me cry?
Well,
I
mean,
crying all day yesterday. I went, just said a lot of time to say prayers for everyone who died because it's just still painful.
Tom Burnett calling his wife, Dina, "Just listen, our plane has been hijacked. It's United 93 from Newark to San Francisco. We're in the air. The hijackers have already knifed a guy. One of them has a gun. They're telling us there's a bomb on board. Please call the authorities." And he hung up. I mean, even just the courage and the wherewithal to make that call to get the information out to alert authorities. Then he calls back again. And some of this, by the way, again, we mentioned yesterday, if you haven't seen United 93.
You have to see United 93. It's hard. Bring tissue.
Yeah. It's really well done.
It's accurate, too.
So then he calls back. They're in the cockpit. The guy they knifed is dead. His wife said he's dead. "Yes, I tried to help, but I couldn't get a pulse." Tom, then she tells him what's happening. "Tom, they're hijacking planes all in up and down the East Coast. They're taking them and hitting designated targets. They've already hit both towers of the World Trade Center." Tom says to Dina, "They're talking about crashing this plane. It's a suicide mission." He's telling people around him and she, as well as her. He asks which airline is involved. She said at the time, I mean, just remember what we knew and didn't know and how fast we knew it. She says to him, "They didn't know if they're commercial planes or not. The news reports are speculating cargo planes, private planes, and commercial. No one knows. How many planes are there? They're not sure. At least three, maybe more," Dina says to Tom. "Do you know who's involved?" "No." Tom tells her, "We're turning back toward New York. We're going back to the World Trade Center." "No, wait, we're turning back the other way. We're going south." Right? I mean, they're in the cockpit, probably trying to navigate the plane, the terrorists, and the passengers are trying to figure out what's going on, and they're having this communication with loved ones like Tom and like Tom and Dean are. Third call. She tells him, Dina, "They just hit the Pentagon." And then he tells the people around him. He's just like, "What else can you tell me?" Dina said, "They think five airplanes have been hijacked. One is still on the ground. They believe all are commercial planes. I haven't heard them say which airline, but all of them originate on the East Coast. Do you know who's involved?" "No," Dina tells Tom. The fourth call. "Anything new?" "No." "Where are the kids?" "They're fine." "Tell them I'll talk to them later. I called your parents. They know your plane has been hijacked." "Oh, you shouldn't have worried them. How are they doing?" You know, this husband and wife. And then the last part of the last call. "We're waiting until we're over a rural area. We're going to take back the plane." Dina tells Tom, "No, sit down, be quiet. Don't draw attention to yourself." Tom says, "Dina, if they're going to crash this plane to the ground, we're going to have to do something. What about the authorities?" "Tom, we can't wait for the authorities. I don't know what they could do anyway." It's up to us. I think we can do it. What do you want me to do? Dina says to Tom. Pray. Just pray.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy are talking about Trump in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, for that United 93 memorial ceremony, at which...
it's a really nice memorial they unveiled.
It is. They've got the wind chimes, the Tower of Voice. Is that what they call it? Tower of Voices.
The Tower of Voices.
Right, the 40 chimes representing the 40 people who were killed, murdered on that United 93 flight.
I want to go see it now.
Trump had a number of rhetorical flourishes in his remarks, including the close.
We will remember the 40. We will remember their faces, their voices, their stories, their courage, and their love. And we will remember that free people are never at the mercy of evil, because our destiny is always in our hands.
Free people are never at the mercy of evil. Free people never at the mercy of evil. It's a great phrase, and it's great because it's true. Ed in Oak Brook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
You know what? That was very chilling, Dan, and I never heard that before, and I thank you for doing it, what you read. But the point I want to make is that Trump was a billionaire, or at least had a lot of money, and the fact that he ran for the highest land in the office, he had to know that it was a tremendous amount of exposure, and he made all his money on his own. Now, you compare that to Obama, Clinton, Rahm Emanuel. All the money they ever made was through the government. So you tell me a guy who was plotting and trying to, whatever the liberals are trying to say Trump is, it just doesn't make sense. But yet they control the media, and that's the narrative that's going to play. Mm. Have a nice day.
Thanks for the call, Ed. It was interesting. Powerful was Trump's speech. Even CNN and your best boyfriend, David Gergen.
He's so dreamy. Oh.
So weird. I mean,
about him. But other
weird.
Women agree. People have crushes on David Gergen.
Mrs. Gergen doesn't agree. But here was Poppy Harlow and David Gergen taking right from the feed of Trump's speech and reacting in real time.
Quite a tribute there to the American lives lost, murdered on 9/11 from the president speaking just now in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. David Gergen is back with me. And David, in the words of the president, they boarded that plane as strangers and they entered eternity forever linked as heroes.
It's beautifully written. Very thoughtful speech by the president. I think easily one of his best speeches. For a moment, Poppy, one could almost forget the chaos around us, the acrimony, the poison, and come together. And you can only hope that the president will navigate that course again, that he will understand that the kind of speech he gave today brings us back together and helps in that regard. And that if he will take the lead the way, maybe we can find our way to a better place as a nation.
Mm. So
let me absorb
that. Yeah, sure, exactly.
Let's let that sink in.
Right. Picture David Gergen whispering that into your ear. Comb over and the it's so hot. Oh my God. But that is those are the kindest words you're ever going to hear from CNN about President Trump, so we thought we'd memorialize
them. Right.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Tickets for Freedom Summit Chicago are on sale now at freedomsummitchicago.com. That's freedomsummitchicago.com.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and we were talking about the 9/11 ceremony, the president's words yesterday, remembering everyday heroes on United 93. Also, it was interesting, I saw this at realclearpolitics.com, there was a ground-level video footage from the day, from 9/11/2001 at the World Trade Center that was recently released after a series of FOIA lawsuits to release this footage by the government. And, it was chilling, fascinating.
Yeah.
Some of the interviews of these journalists that were on the ground in real time as this was happening. I mean, you see the World Trade Center buildings smoldering before they collapse.
Yeah.
And then there's instances of people of journalists talking to first responders on the ground, talking to people who had just escaped one of the burning towers. One everyday hero, just to give you a flavor of it, and just so we remember the everyday heroes whose names sort of fade into our memories, but should be memorialized in history. One is a gentleman named Mike Benfanti, who had just escaped the World Trade Center, talked about what just happened.
I had 40 people in there, just explosion. There's a light flash out my window. My whole doorway to the entrance of my office blew open. My office was freaking out. And I just told them to calm down and get to the center of the office. Everybody was fine on my floor, and we just started heading down the stairs. I heard people were trapped in the bathroom. I ran to the bathroom. It was just blown out. I asked if anybody was in there. People weren't in there. So I started going down the steps. I heard people shouting. I stopped at like 68, and there's a woman in a wheelchair, and I got her in the strap wheelchair and just carried her down the steps and carried her down 68 floors, man. And then we got lost on the fifth floor. It was chaos. It was just,
what do you work for?
Network Plus Communications Company out of Randolph, Massachusetts. Mike Benfanti, Benfante.
You know, everyday heroes like Benfante who helped a 60-year-old woman in a wheelchair.
In a wheelchair.
And, I mean, you see the scenes, and it's post-apocalyptic. I mean, it's just incredible. But it's important to remember. And it's important to remember heroes from who've served our country going back to World War II.
And the Korean War.
Korean War. I mean, wow. People who have served our country from World War II forward who are still with us, as well as the heroes from our country's founding forward. And one of the organizations that does a great job of that, of course, is Honor Flight. Mary Pettinato is the CEO and co-founder of Honor Flight Chicago. They're making their 88th trip to Washington, D.C. today, and she joins us to tell us a little bit about that. Mary, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan.
So
excited to be here.
Well, thank you. And so who's
Mary.
Who's on the flight today?
Hi, Amy. So today we have 98 World War II and Korean War heroes who are so excited to join us. We've got Jake Molter, who was supposed to fly last month but had a fall and had to cancel, and they thought he'd never be able to fly again. He took a turn for the better, and he's excited and waving at everyone, saying, I'm back, I'm here. I'm so excited that I can fly today. So we've got 15 World War II heroes and 84 Korean War heroes. And, you know, the Korean War was really never recognized. It was called a conflict for many, many years. These veterans cry when we invite them to fly with us. They called it the Forgotten War, and now 60-plus years later, we're finally remembering it.
And it's so special. I was able to go with you guys back in 2011, I do believe. And water cannons greet you when you arrive at Washington Dulles Airport. And it's really a hero's welcome along the way and even when you arrive back home. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, absolutely. And I should add that I talked to veterans from that trip, and they still say, you know, Amy Jacobson kissed me.
I was wheelchair candy.
Oh, boy, be careful.
So the trip is all about every opportunity that we can to say thank you. From the time we land at Dulles Airport and there's a water cannon salute and the veterans just look out the window and see this the fire cannons on either side hitting the plane and it forms the shape of a V and it V for victory. It's the highest honor you can bestow on a retiring pilot or a plane. Captain Sullenberger was given a water cannon salute when he retired. From there to police escorts all through D.C. Imagine 5 motor coach buses being escorted by police, and everyone has to pull off the road because heroes are coming. And they look up thinking it's a rock and roll band, and they realize that it's our American heroes.
Huh.
So we go to, you know, Air Force Memorial, Lincoln Korean and Vietnam Memorial, World War II, and the last stop is to see the Enola Gay and the planes that sure. That covered many of our soldiers and from World War II and Korea. And then we get back on the plane, and unbeknownst to the veterans, we've done mail call.
Oh, just that's like they so had emotional.
Isn't that the best?
Yeah,
baby?
And they'd ask you if you're a volunteer, if you ever can volunteer, they ask you, you have to read, some of them have, you know, a hard time reading or seeing the words, so you have to read the letters to them, and it's just waterworks. It's so beautifully written, and just things that people wanted to say to their grandpa or their husband or their dad that they never said before.
One veteran said on a last flight, yesterday, I was able to read my own eulogy. He said, my children wrote about how much I meant to them and how much I've imparted to them and the lessons that they've learned thanks to my guidance.
That's awesome.
How lucky can one get?
That's awesome.
So then now they're clutching their mail to their chest, and the welcome home of a lifetime is at Midway Airport. It's Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and Coast Guard standing at attention, saluting bagpipers, and hundreds of people at Midway Airport that are out to say thank you.
Well, and don't forget, also part of that welcome home is the Amy Jacobson kissing booth at Midway Airport.
We'll be up and running this year.
So, yeah, so you have that.
And before we say that, we're going to have to call security. I'm not sure if we can handle the crowd.
Oh,
yeah. No, exactly.
Like, get in line,
sure.
Please.
Yeah. There's no question about that.
Well, how can people?
And I'm not kidding.
Yeah, well, how can people help out and donate to this cause? Because it really is, it's life-changing. If you ever can volunteer, it sticks with you for the rest of your life because it means the world to these veterans.
Absolutely. So as far as the most important way that they could help is to donate. We normally have 7 flights per year, and this year we had to cut it down to 6 because we just didn't have the donations to make that 7th flight. So it costs $1,200 to fly one American hero for an all-expense-paid everything. There's just nothing that we scrimp at. And any help, $1, $5, $10, anything that you could do to help. We had a little boy, a 6-year-old, in the last flight, you know, missing his 2 front teeth, that walked up at the end of the day and said, I just got my allowance. Will this dollar help to get my grandpa or someone else on the trip? Yes. So any amount helps.
And I mean, and you know, there's a sense of urgency about this, too. I don't mean to be macabre, but not just World War II veterans, but Korean War veterans are getting up in age, too. And so obviously, 88 trips, you've served thousands of veterans, but there's many more to serve just in the Chicago area.
Absolutely. We have over 1,500 on our waiting list.
Okay.
And the average age is 87. So it's a sacrilege to have any on our waiting list. And with help, we hope to have many, many, many more flights honoring all of our American heroes.
The website again, people can...
HonorFlightChicago.org, HonorFlightChicago.org. And many of our seniors who may be listening can also call us at 773-227-VETS, V-E-T-S, or 8387. 773-227-8387.
And the website again, HonorFlightChicago.org. Mary Pettinato, thanks so much for joining us and for your great work, Honor Flight Chicago's great work. Have fun today and have safe travels.
Thank you so much, both Dan and Amy. And this flight is our 8,000th veteran that we're celebrating.
Wow.
So we've flown more veterans than any other honor flight in the country, and we're quite proud of that.
That's awesome. That's a nice thing to be prideful of here in Chicago. Mary, thanks again for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Cheers.
And I have to tell you, it is a long day. They pick up veterans at 5 in the morning, and you travel so many different places. It's you get home at about 9 o'clock at night, but it is worth it just to meet different veterans. And 3 of the ones, gentlemen that I was proud enough to wheel around Washington to D.C. have passed away, but they were so grateful for that moment. So if you know anybody, if you have a loved one who's a World War II veteran or a Korean War veteran, please call Honor Flight Chicago and hook them up with a flight. And Mary joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch. and it feels so good. You switch to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, since we were talking about flights, honor flight, here was an honorable thing that an American Airlines pilot did. You see this? American Airlines flight 2354 delayed at Wichita Falls Regional Airport because of weather.
Yeah, it was diverted there, right?
Yeah.
Had to...
The pilot sort of provided some aid and comfort. I mean, think about being stranded in Wichita Falls.
I've been to that airport. Not a lot going on, I can tell you that much.
So
you can go for a 5-mile run, though. I did.
Okay. Well,
I mean, there's one concession stand, and they're not really selling food.
Well,
it's really sparse.
This ingenious pilot made life a little bit better for the stranded passengers. You would have missed out on this if you were on the flight. You would have been running on the tarmac. But other people would have been enjoying pizza because he ordered 40 pizzas for all the stranded passengers.
Oh, that's spectacular.
Yeah.
And he paid for it and tipped the pizza delivery guy, I hope?
Yeah, well.
Hey, you got to fork over some cash.
He jogged over to a Papa John's delivery driver.
Uh-huh.
And brought 40 pizza boxes back. Food was handed out to the passengers and took off. Ultimately, they made their way to DFW, their destination.
That is so cool.
How about that?
Have you ever been diverted where you're supposed to, you know, like to Milwaukee or Rockford? Or?
Have I ever been a flight diverted to another airport?
Yeah. It's kind of unsettling.
Not that I can think of. Why? Could you think like something mechanical is going wrong? They need to make an emergency landing or something?
Yeah. And then you think, oh, what's going on in the world? Is there another 9/11 happening? What's going on? Are they really telling us the truth? And yeah.
Yeah, I'm not jumpy about air travel. It would be a problem being a pilot, private pilot, my little Cessna, if I was. So I'm not really jumpy about that. But it is interesting to think about 17 years later, how jumpy people were, understandably, after 9/11.
Oh, people canceled weddings. People didn't go to weddings and family gatherings. And I really thought the airline industry was going to shut down.
Well, remember,
for a while.
There was.
Which it did. I mean, O'Hare Airport was closed for days.
And there was a significant bailout of the major carriers. People forget about that.
Oh, that's
as well.
Right. The government bailout.
Yeah.
And then TSA began.
Yes.
Government employees, yes.
That's a good example of the typical government overreaction and misapplying the wrong remedy to the security issue at airports, because I don't think federalizing TSA has netted out particularly well in retrospect, but that's the government.
I have to go home.
Yeah, and... Doctor, what was his name?
Doctor Dow.
Dow, yeah, Doctor Dow agrees with me.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Tucker Carlson there on the Tucker Carlson Show on the Fox News Channel. Sort of sparked a little bit of a debate, mostly among cable news talking heads, but it's a worthy debate in the context of 9/11, remembering 9/11 yesterday. And it's about diversity. Tucker Carlson offered this monologue on Friday talking about how E Pluribus Unum, our national motto from many one, has been replaced by diversity is our strength. But is diversity our strength? That's a question he asked. Or is there something that necessarily binds us as Americans, and something that better bind us as Americans lest civil society descend into madness and division and unrest? Tucker Carlson been criticized by the left, of course, if you challenge the notion that diversity is strength, that's the important thing about America, then you're de facto racist and sexist and suffer from all the phobias and are a purveyor of all the isms and so forth. Well, he picked up this debate yesterday, or the other day, I'm not sure, maybe it was Monday, but in the context, again, of remembering 9/11 and talking about national unity, it's an important discussion to revisit. Here's Tucker Carlson responding to his critics.
America is a country the size of a continent with 325 million people in it. What holds all of that together? What's the glue? It certainly doesn't need to be ethnicity or religion, but it does need to be something. Countries don't remain united without a reason. What's ours? You'd think our elites would be staying up late thinking about that. They're not. They haven't given it a thought, and they don't want you to give it a thought either. Diversity is our strength, they shout. It's an inadequate response from an inadequate leadership class. Meanwhile, they fan the flames of mindless tribalism. Division helps them maintain their power, even as it destroys our country. They have no interest in national unity. They have no interest in the nation state itself, actually. That's merely a barrier to their advancement. But there are a lot of people, including us, who still care about America, the nation. And it's worth thinking about why we are still a country. What do we all have in common? What do we all believe? What's the American idea?
What do we all have in common? What's the tie that binds? Is it diversity and a belief that diversity is our strength? Or is it something more profound than that? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. It was interesting he made note that fanning the flames of division is how the elites stay in power. Well, that's exactly the same thing that Barack Obama said on Friday at U of I. Precisely the same thing, that Donald Trump is a symptom of the times, a function of the resentment that politicians have flamed over time. Of course, he excluded himself, and I would include him at the top of the list of people who fanned the flames of resentment and promoted division. But it was interesting that they see the same issue, as do I. There's no question. But diversity, that's the big idea. Diversity needs an agent, or diversity happens naturally. People are different sexes. People are different races. People have different faiths. Does that need a political sponsor? Does diversity need to be squired around by the federal government, or does it just happen in the context of a nation of 330 million people? And if it happens in the context, regardless of any oversight or micromanagement, then why is that our strength? Something more profound must be our strength, right?
Right. Well, diversity isn't this diversity?
What in the hell's diversity?
Well, I could be wrong, but I believe diversity is an old, old wooden ship that was used during the Civil War era.
Yes, that also. It's the Ron Burgundy People's History of the United States. There's no question about that.
But diversity is what makes our country unique.
Well,
in a way, you know, because if we were all, you know, the same homogeneous, it'd be boring. We are diverse, and that's why people came from all different lands to make America what it is.
Right. So what's
a
right?
Diverse place.
Exactly. So
it
what
should be have attached a negative connotation to it? The word, you know, being diverse.
Should it have a positive connotation? Here's the example I always use: is what? Diversity our strength? Okay. Is that the tie that binds us? Okay. So three black gentlemen are having a conversation, and we introduce a neo-Nazi. The group has become more diverse. Has it become stronger?
Why isn't it to be? Why can't it just be a blonde Swede?
Because that doesn't make my point. My point is to say that the problem with the introduction of the neo-Nazi is what? That the neo-Nazi is white? No. The problem is that the neo-Nazi believes that the black gentlemen are inferior to him. He's wrong. He doesn't share the same values. He doesn't have the same understanding that we're the Christian ideal on which this nation was founded, that everyone is equal in the eyes of God, and everyone should be equal in the eyes of the law here. Same rights, responsibilities.
Yep.
Right? So the reason that more diverse group got weaker is because you introduce somebody who doesn't believe in the shared values of this country. So that's why. It's not opposition to diversity, because that's a pointless conversation. It happens naturally. And fine. That's not the problem. The problem is when you make non-behavioral characteristics like your race, your sex, your religion. The only thing that defines, and the thing by which you must be categorized, and importantly, and oh, by the way, this is something, you know, freed slave Frederick Douglass argued against. You start to confer benefits or impose responsibilities based on those non-behavioral characteristics, which is what we've done. Create classes of people who are entitled to something based on those non-behavioral characteristics, or who must shoulder a burden based on those non-behavioral characteristics. That's when you divide people up. That's when you engender resentment. That's when you fan the flames of division. And that's what Tucker Carlson is getting to. In point of fact, those people who count by race as the means to get a colorblind society and every other non-behavioral characteristic I mentioned, they are the ones who are suffering from the isms and the phobias they like to project on others. Craig in Mount Greenwood, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan. Hey, Amy. Yeah, it's definitely freedom. That separates us from the other countries and other places. I mean, but all different people have different things. Like, some are coming here with the hope of freedom. There's the people that are here that are being held together by the freedom that they have in being able to take and excel and being able to take and make money and being able to have different things that people in other lands can't have.
Thanks for the call, Craig. Appreciate that. Well, and just to Craig's point, this is why Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Colin Kaepernick, Kamala Harris, all the other socialists of the Democrats, I don't care if they're blonde Swedes or Latina or black or white or wherever they come from, whatever they believe in terms of their faith tradition, don't care. The idea of a government-centric society is an anathema to the foundation of this country. So socialism, which is just a slow walking totalitarianism, is not consistent with our shared values. And if that becomes the shared experience of this country, then America will cease to be the America that it has been, not just upon which it was founded, that it has been for the last 240 years. So sort of important, these big ideas. So when Tucker Carlson makes the point that we should be thinking about the ties that bind us or should bind us, and we should be having those conversations and making those arguments rather than just cult of personality politics, which is so much easier and so much cheaper. Candace in DuPage.
Dan, those are really great points. DeSantis and Ted Cruz, in my opinion, are struggling because they cannot articulate what you just articulated. They're putting labels, like you said, on things, which really, for the millennials, isn't enough context. And I think that's why I'm fairly scared about both elections being so close. They shouldn't be at all. But you're right, there's no education. You know, and when my grandmother and grandfather, he was a German, she was Danish, when they came here in some program, they never spoke their native language again because they were so proud to be American. And when my grandfather died of a heart attack and my grandmother was widowed and she needed to go work, she went and worked for a Jewish man who sold suits, and she was a seamstress. So, I mean, E Pluribus One, it works, and it has always worked. And you're right. I think that he poked a hornet's nest with this whole thing because it's just so much truth, and we're in such a crazy world right now where truth is hated.
Thanks for the call, Candace. Just again, to that end, you have to make arguments, like cogent arguments where there is a thesis and evidence to support the thesis and a contemplation of the antithesis. I mean, that's the way you persuade people, give them the whole picture. But I agree with what Candace is saying. Too many politicians who believe what Tucker Carlson was saying or what I just articulated they fall into the trap of just playing the label game with the left. The label game doesn't get you anywhere, which is why you can call me a racist all day, and Tucker Carlson clearly feels the same way, because that's all you have to offer is a label. You can expose your anti-intellectualism. You can expose your ignorance all day and call me all the names under the sun, because I know who I am and I can articulate what I believe and why I believe it, to give lie to the labels. But that's what you have to do. You have to give lie to the label, and you don't do it by just responding with a label. Then it's just the label game. That's a loser. It's a loser for the Republican Party, to put it in the context of partisan politics, but more importantly, it's a loser for the country.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Damey, Dan and Amy, and Damey, we're talking about diversity. Isn't that fun? Mashups, yeah. Like, wait, what was Bennifer?
Bennifer.
Sure. It's a classic.
Who else?
So many. Was there a J-Lo? Was there Justin Timberlake and Jennifer Lopez? I mean, she's dated everybody else. I don't know.
She never dated Justin Timberlake. Mika, Joe and Mika.
Oh, Joyka.
Joyka.
That's what I. We'll talk about Joyka in a second after the news. But we're talking about what binds us as a nation. Is diversity our strength? Tucker Carlson sparked a bit of a discussion on it with the commentaries in his show the last couple nights. Joe in Villa Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
I'm going to have to disagree with you on this one, Dan, with label politics, because the American public wants their Jimmy John sandwich yesterday. They want everything so quick, and they don't have time to, and they're just so shallow. They don't think about, you know, these things. Cortez could come out and say, socialism, we're going to give everybody everything, but no one's going to sit down and have the debate with her and have the honest discussion of how is one going to pay for it. Even though I wish I could agree with you, Dan, the American public is so dumbed down. I think that it's past the tipping point.
All right. Well, thanks for the call,
Joe. Sure. Everybody wants free stuff, especially college students. Oh, that sounds great. They don't care who's going to pay for it, but somebody else is paying for it.
Here's what I would say to that, though. One is, I think it's a little bit of a bootstrap argument, and that's what politicians use to avoid having to make the argument, because it's more difficult, it's more time-consuming, takes more effort. It's just easier to play the labels game. And so people take the path of least resistance as long as they don't lose their benefits by doing so. So I think there's a little bit of a low expectations game that we've played too. You know, people don't know what they don't know. People don't miss what they're not, what they can't conceive. And in our politics these days, it's difficult to even conceive of what I'm talking about, because outside of maybe Ben Sasse, you don't have too many elected officials connecting dots for people, making arguments. But this is how you move public opinion. So you can choose to say, I'm not even going to bother with making the arguments. I'm not even going to bother with connecting the dots. I'm not even going to bother with laying out the facts, because people are too stupid. Well, then here's what's going to happen. You'll have flim flam men and women come along, Harold Hill style, and sell them a bill of goods. That's how we got Barack Obama for 8 years. That's how we're getting a lot of these politicians.
It's the shiny object in the room.
Well, I mean,
well, they know they voted for him because they want to tell their grandkids, I voted for the first African-American president.
Well, but
which is great. You can still tell them that because you did.
But this is cult of personality politics that I'm talking about. And this is the flim-flammery that people then become susceptible to, because what's the other side offering? Different flim-flammery? You're this and the other side is that. You say the other side is this and you're that. Just the label game, the cult of personality game, the cardboard cutout candidate that we need.
Check all the boxes.
It becomes self-fulfilling.
Minority.
So perhaps if we did something markedly different, we would produce markedly different outcomes. Perhaps if we sort of elevated our expectations for others, they would elevate their expectations for themselves and what's possible. The thought, Bruce in Bloomingdale.
Morning, guys. Dan, the one flaw in your logic is that you cannot reason a person out of a position that they weren't reasoned into in the first place. We need to get it through our heads. The left hates us. They hate us. They hate our smelly Walmart shopping faces to paraphrase Peter Stroke. Just yesterday, some nutball in California tried to stab a minor Republican candidate for Congress to death at a town fair.
Yeah.
Do you think we're going to reason with these people?
No.
Do you think logic and persuasion is going to work on them?
No, but thanks for the call, Bruce. No, not with everybody. But remember, this has never been an everybody proposition. This is a representative republic. This is majoritarian rule, minority rights. So this is a 50% plus one proposition, maybe a 60% proposition, really, to spark a movement in one direction or the other. So, you know, I think there are people that have foundational beliefs that differ, and I think there are a lot of people that struggle with what their foundational beliefs are, and they're susceptible to the cult of personality politics of which I was speaking. But I've never suggested it's a 100% proposition. It never has been. It never will be. But that doesn't mean we don't chart the course that I'm suggesting.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, Joe Walsh here. Whose side are you on? What side are you on? We'll talk about that when freedom returns at 5.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Condolences to Comrade Bernie and his dutiful wife, Jane. Levi's their offspring, I think.
Yeah. No, he looks exactly like his dad. He's younger, obviously, but they look about the same age. But yeah, he came in dead last. He
seven,
got one.
No, seventh.
1%. He voted for himself and a few other people.
Yeah, ran for a congressional seat in New Hampshire, right?
Yeah. And his dad didn't really do anything to
help
promote his son, but yeah.
You know why?
That's embarrassing.
Because from each according to their needs, from each according to their means, I guess he didn't feel like Levi needed it. And since he is, you know, wants to be an arbiter of that matter, that's how it goes. You live by the commissar, you die by the commissar.
And what, Bernie didn't have a real job until he was 40?
And if you call that, he was like a mayor of some town in Vermont.
Okay.
Yeah. And still hasn't, but he's done well. And he's put together a record of accomplishment. I think he's got two post offices named in his 3 decades in Congress.
Okay.
So, you know, there's that. And, of course, using his bully pulpit to promote totalitarianism. Can't discount that. Speaking of using their bully pulpit, Joe Scarborough wrote an op-ed in the Amazon Post about President Trump. And rather than me read it, I know how you'd like to hear the salient points from the Scarborough op-ed. You'd like to hear it read to you by Mika.
Oh, that's right.
Of course.
His fiance. Have they got married yet? Are you getting an invite to the wedding?
I'm paying attention. I've never...
Bridal shower?
I don't think I've ever seen the show.
Yeah. Oh, I've watched it. It's insufferable. The only way to watch it is via Saturday Night Live when they make fun of them.
Yeah.
And they're pawning all these... And their chairs keep getting closer and closer and closer together.
They are ridiculous. And here's an example of it. Mika reading Joe's op-ed from the Washington Post.
Boy.
16 years of strategic missteps have been followed by the maniacal moves of a man who has savaged America's vital alliances, provided comfort to hostile foreign powers, attacked our intelligence and military communities, and lent a sympathetic ear to neo-Nazis and white supremacists across the globe. For those of us still believing that Islamic extremists hate America because of the freedoms we guarantee to all people, the gravest threat Trump poses to our national security is the damage done daily to America's image.
Mm. And one more flourish.
Or whether they will continue supporting a politician who has done more damage, and listen to this, more damage to the dream of America than any foreign adversary ever could.
Trump has done more damage to the dream of America than any foreign adversary ever could. Joe Scarborough, a former Republican congressman from Florida, you know, but then he became a media guy. He wanted to hang out with all the Eastern Seaboard elites and it started to move around a little bit, as often happens to those that are not moored to anything substantive. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Is Scarborough right? Trump represents the greatest threat to the dream of America in the world. That's what he said. More than any foreign adversary, the damage he does on a daily basis to America's image. And it's very much like that New York Times anonymous op-ed, Scarborough's, you know, because he's a sort of a, you know, Dumas and a not a particularly good writer. So it's generic. It's the same sort of warmed over talking points of the DNC, right? Isn't it? You know, foreign power. Be specific. Give me a specific example to support the contention that you're making. There's no specifics. It's just a general litany of aid and comfort to the enemy, ruining America's image, fraying traditional alliances, so on and so forth. Well, give me a topic and let's talk about it specifically. You want to talk about NATO? You want to talk about Western Europe? You want to talk about Russia? You want to talk about North Korea? You want to talk about China? Let's talk about something specific.
Well, maybe it's press conference with Putin that rubbed people the wrong way, but then say it.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Press conference that rubbed people the wrong way. And I understand that. The press conference rubbed me the wrong way. But Joe Scarborough and his ilk suggested the Helsinki press conference was worse than 9/11. The Helsinki press conference was worse than Pearl Harbor. They're out of their minds. And probably they're out of their minds on purpose to play for an audience that's out of their minds or to generate one. It's interesting because there was a gentleman who spoke at the 9/11 ceremony at Ground Zero. Mm-hmm. Did you see that? His name is Nicholas Harris. He was remembering his mom who was killed in 9/11, 76-year-old mom. He in his 2 minutes that he got to speak to remember his mom had a message for the media about this. Do we have Nicholas Harris? All right, we'll effort that here. Mike on the north side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Thanks for taking my call, kids. Boy, Mika's right. She got me. I'm a white supremacist. I'm a neo-Nazi. As I go to my job to take the drug test so I could pay 50% of my salary in taxes and fees to the freeloaders who don't have to work to take a drug test. Dan, what you were talking about before 6:30, you were right on the button, but you're a man ahead of your time, about 2 years ahead of your time. Let the socialists take over. Let Buddy Hackett Jr. become governor. And when everybody sees they pay an extra $200 to $300 a month more in income tax for this progressive tax, because it never hits the rich. If you want to see how much more you're going to pay in tax, go and look at the state of Minnesota's progressive taxes. That's what they're modeling their plan on. So you could talk all the rhetoric you want, but until the money comes out of their pockets, people aren't going to wake up. Perfect example was last year. My daughter had her first paying summer job when she was being paid on a check. And when she saw how much they were taking out, the government, she said, "What's that for?" I said, "That's for the people that are too lazy to work." She became a Republican.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Here's the thing I would say about this whole matter of, you know, people aren't going to wake up until this and people aren't going to wake up until that. And you've got these people that are, as our previous caller mentioned, this knife attack of a Republican congressional candidate in California and so on and so forth, the unhinged, the purposeful arsonist, rhetorical arsonist like Joe Scarborough. Do you think that it ever bothered the left that the positions they were taking were not majority positions? Did they not force feed those into law? I mean, no. If just for example, just to kind of try and crystallize the kind of turnaround in a short amount of time like we've almost never seen in this country's history, try and find a reference to marriage redefinition, quote-unquote gay marriage, before 1995. Try and find one. Yeah, the Democrat president of the United States wouldn't embrace marriage redefinition until 5 minutes before the Obergefell decision, basically. You know, their titular leader wouldn't embrace it. certainly wasn't helping it. Want to stay away from it in 08, want to stay away from it in 12, basically. And I'm sorry, what's the law of the land? Right now, it's probably about a 50-50 proposition. So for the past 20 years, or the 20 years leading up to the Obergefell decision, you think that the cultural Marxists and the gay rights types, you think they were worried about, forget it. Forget it. Look at all the people who don't understand our position. Look at all the people who disagree with us. What's the point? Of course not. Motivated minorities. You know, they use bigot baiting, shaming, solidarity and marginality, agitprop. But they didn't say, this is impossible. Because it's not. It's a question of the quality of the arguments we're making, not just in advance of our vision, but in terms of helping people understand the leftist vision, the cultural Marxists, the Ocasio-Cortezes and the Comrade Bernies and the Kamala Harrises, amoral pursuit of power by the likes of a Cory Booker. It's your responsibility in the public arena. And so just going back to those points and the political points that Scarborough is trying to score against the president, Nicholas Harris in New York at Ground Zero at the 9/11 remembered ceremony yesterday.
Mom, I will never forget you with the abundance of love you gave me. And one more thing, if I may. This year, a representative of the House referred to our loss as just another incident. This year, a network commentator said the president's performance in Helsinki was a traitorous act, as was 9/11. And last week, a senator attacked a Supreme Court nominee and called him a racist for alleged comments after 9/11. Stop. Stop. Please, stop using the bones and ashes of our loved ones as props in your political theater. Their lives, sacrifices, and death are worth so much more. Let's not trivialize them or us. It hurts. To my mom and to all of you and your loved ones, never forget.
So you don't think you can get to Nicholas Harris? I mean, he's referencing Cory Booker at the Kavanaugh hearing. He might as well be referencing Scarborough with this whole comparison of the Helsinki press conference to 9/11, for goodness sakes. But there was any number of pundits on CNN and MSNBC, or former CIA directors for that matter, engaged in the same sort of demagoguery. So you don't think you can persuade Nicholas Harris to a position? You don't think people see what elected officials are doing, can read through it? So against the backdrop of the sleight of hand of a Cory Booker, be authentic. That's the contrast. That's the opportunity. Connect dots rather than try and beguile others in advance of your political power. Don't say that it can't be done because it's done all the time by the left. So by definition, it can be done.
If you're listening to loud classic rock followed by the most casual of political conversations, it must be morning, Joe.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Did you see this political cartoon in Roll Call? See
with
this?
Yes.
This was yesterday in their Capital Inc. section, Roll Call's Capital Inc. The cartoonist is Robert Mattson. The cartoon, if you didn't see it, we'll post
That's
it.
That's not a cartoon.
Never Forget is the title of the cartoon. It shows the two towers, the World Trade Center, as ballot boxes with vote inscribed on each.
Yeah, and a plane heading toward one.
A plane heading toward the two towers that says Russia on it. Never forget Russia meddling in the election, tantamount to 9/11.
That cartoonist should apologize and possibly be fired from his or her job. I don't even know who it is.
Well, I like when people show us who they are. So this anti-Trump cartoonist shows us who he is. Ignorant. An ignoramus. Thank you. By the way, on the same day, Wall Street Journal reporting, President Trump expected to sign an executive order as soon as today that would authorize sanctions against foreigners who attempt to interfere in U.S. elections. The order would be the latest effort by the Trump administration to address concerns raised by intel agencies that Russia is seeking to interfere in the 2018 elections after doing so 2 years ago and basically every election since the Bolshevik Revolution. I love this is all sui generis, the idea of foreign adversaries trying to meddle in our affairs. But okay. All right. So there it is. Foreign meddling in the elections. What about domestic meddling? This was a topic that Mark Stein took up because of this email that was exposed by Tucker Carlson at Fox News. Efforts by a Google executive to increase Latino turnout prior to the 2016 presidential election. The email also includes surprise at Trump's performance among Latino voters, that, you know, where he got almost 30% of the vote, if I'm recalling correctly. A Google spokesman, in response to this email that has not been covered by the D.C. press corps, of course, the views expressed in this email, this is Google spokesman responding, the views expressed in this email and the employee's personal political views and not representative of any official stance from the company. Google's elections efforts, both in 2016 and leading up to this year's midterms, have been entirely nonpartisan. We will continue to use our products in an informative, nonpartisan way to engage voters leading up to November's election. Mark Stein begs to differ.
Well, we should be deeply concerned. As you said, Russia, everyone goes bananas about because they bought 100 grand's worth of Facebook ads or whatever it was. Google is already more powerful in terms of its control over people's lives than almost every government on the planet. And I would say arguably right. It has more control over American lives than, say, the government of Russia does as a practical matter. And people are very naive about Google searches. They think that it doesn't whether you're in a hotel in Des Moines or whether you're hanging upside down in your bondage dungeon in Poughkeepsie, when you enter the search results, everything's the same. As this lady, Eliana Murillo, has explained, they're actually capable of now targeting election content specifically to certain voting groups. So this isn't like, you know, rock the vote or public attempts to get out the vote. This is where the world's most powerful company is using data mining to channel election partisan election information to key voting demographics. That's very disturbing because they'd steal the election and you'd never know it.
I want to get to the substance of what Stein had to say, but whether you're in a hotel room in Des Moines or your bondage dungeon in Poughkeepsie hanging upside down. I think that was a reference to Eric Schneiderman, former New York Attorney General. I'm not sure, but it was joyful nonetheless. But in terms of what Stein had to say and what we know to be true, at least the effort by one Google executive in 2016 to drive Latino turnout by shaping the algorithms just so, that a concern for you? It's fine to be concerned about Russian interference or other foreign interference in our elections. Legitimate concern. What about this as a legitimate concern? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. I mean, Google executives can participate. They're American citizens. They can participate in politics just like I can or anybody else can. But when you participate in politics in a meaningful way to advance the interests of a particular candidate outside of volunteering, you do so providing material support. You know, the same crowd that's very concerned about compliance with FEC regulations when it comes to Trump's hush money payments. Well, there's FEC requirements for in-kind donations or direct donations, too. Google acting as a campaign outpost for the Democrat du jour. Does that concern you? Facebook, Twitter? I mean, that's in part why Sheryl Sandberg and Jack Dorsey were whistled before Congress last week, and Zuckerberg before them. And, of course, Google will not deign to appear before Congress to answer questions. That's worth noting as well. CEO declining to appear before Congress at the same time that Twitter and Facebook execs did. 312-642-5600, Turnkey Depro answer line. 646-36-DA, Turnkey Depro text line. I'm happy to talk election meddling, just like I'm happy to talk about collusion, the breaking of campaign finance laws, the breaking of laws in general in the context of the 2016 election. But why do we only have to talk about one half of it? Why do we only have to talk about controversies swirling around Trump? Why don't we revisit all of the evidence presented in Peter Schweitzer's book, Clinton Cash? Why don't we talk about Uranium One? Why don't we talk about the specifics of the DNC hack? Why is there no interest there? Well, when it comes to election meddling, let's talk about Russia. Let's talk about China. Talk about whoever you want to talk about, so long as you can present some evidence. But when evidence is presented with respect to social media giants, should this be disclosed? I'm not arguing that the government should come in and regulate Google or Facebook or Twitter. I'm opposed to that. But should it be transparent? Well, that's why we have campaign finance laws. So why can't we talk about concerns of meddling in this area? Why does the D.C. press corps refuse to do so? Joe on the South Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, good morning, guys. Thank you. Yeah, the Google should be brought up on for breaking campaign laws. They made a monetary support of that candidate, and that they broke campaign laws in doing that. Then they should be brought up on it.
Thanks for the call, Joe. I mean,
well, what was their reasoning for not showing up? They just
didn't want to.
Didn't want to. Busy that day, were they?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot going
on. They control your reputation. They can shape elections in a hot second.
You have
by what they put at the top of their search engine when you put in somebody's name.
Well, you also, I mean, you're right. You have, you've created a whole industry of reputation management online. Now, all the social media giants have, because people, you know, especially high profile people like you, Amy, want to control what's on their wiki page and want to control their digital footprint and their digital brand. That's absolutely true.
Don't make me Google you again. You better have cleaned it up. I didn't like what I saw last time.
Yeah.
Everybody Google Dan Proft.
The cat
right
pictures.
Now. It's kind of, it's disconcerting. And when did you start becoming a furry?
I'm not a furry, but I've always...
I know what you did in that hotel room in the drawer when you put the kitty litter
no,
in there.
No, that was not me. I've always
dig,
been...
Dig, pee-pee, flip the kitty litter, Keep it in the box next
I'm
time.
Always, you know, I know it belies my image, but I'm a Dr. Doolittle type. I'm friends to animals big and small. It's true. I've got a lot of love to give. Jeff and Gurney, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Amy. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning.
Just calling you from my bondage dungeon in my Avalon.
Are you hanging upside down?
Are you experiencing a head rush right now?
Yes, I am. All the blood's going to my head. At any rate, no, they're not talking about the felons that have been granted voting rights. 10 states are allowing this to happen, illegal immigrants, motor voters in California. And it seems that
De Blasio, New York City, is doing a voter drive in the prisons. He's doing a GOTV effort in the prisons.
That's okay. Right. The motor pool is actually taking applications as we speak. But it's so frustrating to see Google, Twitter, Facebook. You know, this lady from Google trying to get the Hispanic vote up, but yet they have no problem just displaying all this stuff about Russia. It's almost like they don't like anybody else muscling in on their territory when they're trying to do the exact same thing themselves. And again, just like when Obama was in office, nothing but deflection. Don't look at me, look at them. And all the while, you know, it's just like the old adage, the people who are stealing, the people who accuse everyone of stealing is the one who's stealing the most. So the one who's upset that people are rigging the elections are the ones that are rigging them the most. So have a great day. Thanks for listening, and talk to you later.
Thanks, Jeff.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer
on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy are talking about Googling out the vote, as it were. Election skullduggery of perhaps an illicit nature with respect to social media companies. Why wouldn't we want to talk about that, too? Why wouldn't we want to expose such illicit election skullduggery wherever it exists? Why is the D.C. press corps only interested in Russia? Will and Skokie.
Hey, how you doing? You know, I think this whole thing is basically trying to set stuff up so that from now on, whenever the left loses, they can always claim that there was some kind of, irregularities to voting. You know, even going back as far as Bush v. Gore, you know, they kept saying, well, gee, we'll just keep recounting until we'll get to, we'll get the count we want. They did the same thing in Minnesota with Al Franken. You know, that was totally a fraudulent election.
Against Norm Coleman.
It's really scary because we're never going to be able now to trust the election process. And that's, I think, what they're ultimately after, is basically doing away with the public's trust of the election process.
Thanks for the call, Will. Speaking of skullduggery.
Oh, the lovebirds are back in the news this morning, I saw.
Who is your favorite leftist couple? Is it the G-Men, Strzok and Page, or Joyka?
I think Strzok and Page. You know why? Because he's such a little twit. I mean, there was no contrition when he was up there. His fists were, together, ready to fight back. And
yeah, but Joyka has been memorialized on Saturday Night Live.
Isn't that? Yeah,
here we go. All right, Mika, you're being dramatic.
No, but here's what I'm sorry.
Hey, Mika Mouse.
What's happening? And here's
you're
what
being
I
a little
say.
Stinker.
But let me
you're being a little stinker.
Say,
hey,
I'm not being a stinker.
Mika Boo.
Am I being
Mika
a
Boo.
Stinker?
Yeah. You're being a stinker, and it's not going to work.
Yeah? To you, I guess. Yeah.
And they start mauling each other, of course.
And then eventually she sits on his lap.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I'd like to see Strzok and Page parodied as well. They're difficult to parody, admittedly. More text exchanges out.
Between the lovebirds.
That's right. Something else you won't probably get to much coverage of from the D.C. press corps.
Should we cue the romantic music, or is this more of a sinister tone?
Well, this is more of Mark Meadows, Republican congressman, releasing a timeline characterizing the text messages. So we don't have a lot of pillow talk here. Sorry.
We're going to stop him.
April 10th of last year, 2017, Strzok contacts Page to discuss a media leak strategy.
Oh, here we go. Just got interesting. Oh, yeah. Media leaks. Let's do it, honey. Come on, baby. How much do you love me?
That is hot. Media leak strategy. The text from Strzok. I had literally just gone to find this phone to tell you I want to talk to you about media leak strategy with DOJ before you go.
Stop. Say it in your dirty voice.
This is how Strzok
Come
talks.
Come on. Like this. Hey, I want to meet you to tell you about some leaks. I don't have that paper.
Yeah.
Or I'd play along.
Uh-huh.
I take two.
All right, I'll do it in my best David Gergen to get you worked up.
Cue the music. He's going to do David Gergen.
Hold on, let me comb over my hair. Let me go full Gergen.
I don't know what it is about David Gergen.
Nobody does.
He should make a calendar.
Yes.
I want to see the month of June.
That's a freedom summon. You can get exclusive copies of Amy Jacobson's David Gergen tribute calendar. April 12th, 2 days later.
Yes.
Strzok congratulates Page on a job well done, referring to two derogatory articles about Carter Page. Strzok warns Page that two articles are coming out, one that is worse than the other about Carter Page, and tells her, well done, Page.
Well done, Page.
Yeah.
I'll see you later tonight?
No.
Darn it!
You're ad-libbing.
Darn it!
Now.
Come on! Don't let the facts get in the way of a good story.
Yeah. And that was on April 22nd of last year. And this is how you memorialize any romantic relationship. You timestamp everything so you can go back through it.
Right.
Yeah. 410. Remember on 410? Remember that was so great? I said media leaking strategy. And then 2 days later, I sent you two articles. And then 10 days later, I said the article's out. Well done. Remember those times?
Oh, yeah.
Those were good times. Strzok's attorney. I love talking about Peter Strzok over 50 Shades of Grey. Strzok's attorney said in a statement that the media leak strategy refers to a department-wide initiative to detect and stop aides sharing information with the media. Yeah. I don't know how that could possibly square with the article is out, well done page regarding to leaking an article to the media as opposed to stopping aides from sharing information to the media. They were sharing information with the media. That's what Strzok and Page were doing and placing stories. So just in terms of,
and that's fraudulent and biased behavior.
Right.
And plain and simple.
And this was a guy who, you know, was allegedly Torquemada to Hillary Clinton, you know, the grand inquisitor on these two important cases in the 16th cycle into last year. And the more information you get on these two, the more it looks like they were actually trying to execute some sort of insurance policy, contingency plan to undermine, disrupt, delegitimize the president of the United States. Senior level of the FBI. Again, something that's of no interest. That election meddling, not interesting. Google, social media, not interesting. $100,000 in Facebook ads from Russia, the world stops. Okay.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Tickets for Freedom Summit Chicago are on sale now at freedomsummitchicago.com. That's freedomsummitchicago.com.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Coming up on October 3rd, former Arkansas governor and presidential candidate Mike Huckabee is going to be in town at the Union League Club. He's headlining the Aid for Women 40th anniversary dinner, 40 years of helping women who are in crisis with a pregnancy. Aid for Women is a Catholic crisis pregnancy center, life-affirming pregnancy center I'm affiliated with. And so we're excited to have Mike Huckabee come into town. October 3rd, Aid for Women Chicago, if you want to get more information on that dinner and otherwise support the good work that Aid for Women does and the pro-life movement more generally, of course, which Mike Huckabee is a hero of. And coming up right now, we have the aforesaid Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee. Governor Huckabee, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan. Good to be with you and Amy this morning, and I'm looking forward to being in Chicago on October 3rd.
Yeah, we're looking forward to having you. And some news out yesterday that I wanted to get your take on. U.S. job openings, 17-year high. Business starts, all-time high. And I wanted to give you the opportunity to thank President Obama for those accomplishments.
What I was going to say.
If it weren't for good old Chicago's own Barack Obama, where would we be today? I mean, I cannot begin to tell you how grateful I am for the way that his 8 years just teed it up. Now, it had nothing to do with the fact that President Trump essentially from day one rolled back and reversed every economic policy that President Obama had championed. Like increasing taxes and increasing regulations and trying to put the energy companies of America out of business and making it more and more difficult for businesses to operate and even to give all kinds of special treatment to those who were crashing our economy. So that's, I'm sure, nothing to do with President Trump, at least not if you listen to the major networks. But frankly, and all kidding aside, Americans need to be celebrating the fact that the economic policies of deregulation and lower taxes and taking the boot off the necks of businesses has resulted in jobs. And that's the greatest way to fight poverty in the world. Give people a job.
Now, were you surprised when former President Obama broke protocol and spoke on behalf of the Democratic Party? I know the midterm elections are less than 2 months away, but don't you think somebody else could have and should have delivered that message?
You know, Amy, I'm sure it would have been better, and there's been a long history of former presidents not specifically going after the current president. But, I mean, I think we all have to recognize that we're living in a time when there are no rules anymore. There's no sense of propriety. And I don't fault him so much that he said something. I understand he disagrees with President Trump. I'm sure he's a little bit miffed that the president, current president, has rolled back almost everything he spent 8 years doing. But the other side of that is it gives Americans a great opportunity just to step back, even people who don't like President Trump, and to say, you know, whether I like the guy's personality or not, he's effective. And I say, Amy, he's a lot like the doctor who has been called to come do surgery on you. His bedside manner is deplorable. You know, he's gruff. He can come in and chew out the family for even being in the room. He can be rough on the nurses. But the point is, he's done the surgery 1,200 times, and every patient has survived. Do you want that guy doing your surgery, or a guy who's only done it 3 times and all of his patients have died? I'll take the gruff. I'll be nice, and I'll let the doctor do his magic in the operating room. And this is a president, whether people like his tweets or like some of the comments that he makes, he's a pretty transparent guy. But the fact is, what he does is getting things done, and not just for the economic front, but for those of us who are committedly pro-life. This is, without doubt, the most pro-life president we've ever had, ever. And I think those things matter to people like me.
What about the Republican Party on the Hill, the Republican members of the House and the Senate, who have not fulfilled Paul Ryan's promise to defund Planned Parenthood at the federal level after those David DeLeiden undercover videos exposing just exactly who Planned Parenthood is and just exactly what they do, the gruesome work that they do, that despite the investigation headed up by Marsha Blackburn, now running for the Senate in Tennessee, and all the evidence presented and state-level investigations, Planned Parenthood continues to marshal on, underwritten by U.S. taxpayers?
Well, any Republican who doesn't actively seek to get rid of the blood money that Planned Parenthood gets and uses to kill unborn children, they should be absolutely defeated. Let somebody come who will do what they say. Republicans promised to defund Planned Parenthood. The fact that they haven't is real, an incredible scourge upon the Republicans who lied to the voters, and they need to go home.
You obviously are a political observer in addition to being a former governor, former candidate. How do you feel, speaking of some of the Republican, some of the Trump successes, but also some of the failures, some of the promises not kept, how do you feel 2 months out from the midterms?
I mean, overall, I think if Americans look at this objectively, which many of them won't, but if they did, they would say, why would we put the Democrats back in power? Why would we put Maxine Waters and Nancy Pelosi and Elizabeth Warren in place? Why would we give them leadership? Because what we know is not only are they going to try to go after this president, but Nancy Pelosi thought that the tax cuts that gave workers bonuses and pay raises were nothing but crumbs. Well, say that to the families who were able to put better food on their tables, send their kids to summer camp, put money aside for college, add that room on the house that they hadn't been able to do before. Those aren't crumbs. Those are improvements in life. Take Maxine Waters and her hoping that people will go after folks they disagree with, yelling and screaming at them in public places, and doing to them what happened to my daughter in a small little restaurant in Virginia, where just because you have a different point of view, you get run out of public places and you're not allowed to even have a meal with your family. Mm-hmm. If that's what people want, then vote Democrat. If you love socialism, if you think it works and you love what's happening in Venezuela, vote Democrat. But I cannot imagine that rational, thoughtful, intelligent people would look at sort of a tale of two cities and would say, yep, that's what I'd like. Take more of my money, spend it on wasteful things I hate. And in the meantime, let's go back to a place where we're bowing down before foreign leaders rather than having them really afraid of us and changing what they do in dealing with us.
Governor Huckabee, how did you find out that your daughter was denied service at that restaurant? Did she call you and tell you what happened?
Yeah, we heard about it, pretty soon. And, of course, then it went public and viral. But the real story is a little more intense than what the public has heard. She had driven from Washington to meet her husband and his family at this restaurant. And they were going to stay in Lexington that weekend because her husband's father had gone to Washington and Lee. And it was kind of a, you know, weekend with the entire family. And that included the brothers and sisters and all of them. And so when she walked in, the owner was already there. The owner pretended that she was called in by the employees. That's not true. She was already there. When Sarah walked in, the owner went over to her almost immediately, within 2 minutes, and said, "Miss Sanders, may I speak to you? Could you come with me?" Well, Sarah thought it was just to say, "Honored to have you in our restaurant." You know, I mean, that why else would an owner come over? And she immediately looked at her, and her face was all twisted up, and she said, "I don't like you. I don't want you in my restaurant. You don't represent the values that we hold dear in this community. I don't appreciate the person you work for and what you do, and I would appreciate it if you would leave my restaurant." And Sarah was just stunned. She went over, whispered into her husband's ear, said, "I've been thrown out." So he got up and went with her, and he then said to the family what happened. Well, they got up, and they went down the street. Sarah and Brian left, period. She was just no longer even having an appetite, wanted to just go back to where they were staying and forget it. So she went without dinner. But the rest of the family went, and this owner of the restaurant, the Little Red Hen, or Red Hen, or whatever it's called, walked down the street where they had gone, got on her cell phone, called other people, and then they came down and got out in the street and were yelling and screaming. Finally, one of my son-in-law's, his brother, who is way more liberal than you could imagine, came out and said, "Look, I'm probably more liberal than you. I'm not a Trump supporter. But my sister-in-law is a very nice person, and what you're doing is wrong, and it's ridiculous, and you're creating an embarrassing, unnecessary scene." And then, you know, it was just ugly. Now, here's the long-term effect.
Okay.
As you may have read, that entire community now is really battling because its image has been totally destroyed by that restaurant owner, and they're having to spend an enormous amount of money to try to get people to come back because it's had a big negative effect on tourism. That's unfortunate because it wasn't everyone in that community. But it just shows that when people act selfishly and when they act boorishly and when they act with such hate and bigotry and they bully people, it has an effect not only on their reputation, but unfortunately upon the reputation of those around them.
Well, that is a Paul Harvey quality, and that's the rest of the story.
Because, it's like a mob mentality. I mean, that's scary.
That is not, as you said at the outset, that is not anything close to how this was covered by the D.C. Press Corps. And I'm, of course, not surprised, but those details are really important. Appreciate you sharing that. And I just wonder, going back to Sarah, your daughter, how she is enjoying her time as press secretary. You know, how much she confides in you about the good, the bad, and the ugly of her job.
Well, she loves the job. She knows that it's an extraordinary privilege to be in the position she's in. She said to me just the other day, I was in D.C., which I don't go there very often, but she was saying, you know, when I walk into the White House, there's still a sense of awe and wonder of what this place represents. She said, if I ever get at the place where it just is not real to me, what a privilege it is just to be able to walk in this place, I need to leave. But she has a real appreciation and respect for the president. He treats her wonderfully. She really is frustrated with these stories that keep coming out from people like Bob Woodward and Omarosa, bitter and angry people who will do anything and will say anything and will tell any lie. But what is described in these books about how that there's anxiety and they don't trust the president and they are trying to undermine it, she said that is simply not what happens there day in and day out. And it's just very frustrating to those who are in the true inner circle, not these gutless cowards who write anonymous op-eds for the New York Times, who probably doesn't even work in the White House. But the question is, how do they ever get the press to act with some level of professional responsibility? And so when people say Trump shouldn't be on the press like he is, sometimes he's a little maybe over the top with it. But you know what? If I were being attacked in the relentless way he is, when you have people like Joe Scarborough, who's now become Crazy Joe, who yesterday on 9/11 made the most ridiculous statement dishonoring the 3,000 people killed on 9/11 by saying, that President Trump is a greater threat to America than the jihadist on 9/11. I mean, I don't know how a person can say those kind of things and the rest of the media just sit there and applaud or even be silent. How can you say something so outrageous, so utterly disrespectful to people who lost their loved ones in a terrorist attack, and somehow say that the current president is a greater danger to the country than the people who flew airplanes into buildings?
I'll tell you, the combination of what President Obama said at University of Illinois on Friday and what Joe Scarborough, former Republican congressman from Florida, has become is exactly what gave rise to Trump. They're both swamp creatures who are, you know, completely unself-aware and totally self-indulgent. And this is exactly what President Trump was a response to, in my humble opinion. And I think your daughter, Sarah, has done a great job in an unbelievably difficult post. And we appreciate her efforts. And we look forward to having you in Chicago October 3rd for the Aid for Women 40th anniversary dinner. It's going to be at the Union League Club. Aid for Women, helpaidforwomen.org is the website. Helpaidforwomen.org is the website. Mike Huckabee, you can catch him on Trinity Broadcasting Network, TBN, Saturday and Sunday, 8 p.m. Chicago time. And you can catch him in Chicago on October 3rd at that Aid for Women dinner. Governor Huckabee, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you, Dan and Amy.
God bless. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. President Trump had such a powerful day yesterday.
It was really his finest moment.
His speech you're referring to in Shanksville, yeah. Pennsylvania, at the United 93 memorial ceremony.
He spoke to the victims' family members, but I felt that he was speaking to all of Americans.
On September 11th, 2001, a band of brave patriots turned the tide on our nation's enemies and joined the immortal ranks of American heroes. At this memorial on this sacred earth, in the field beyond this wall, and in the skies above our heads, we remember the moment when America fought back. A piece of America's heart is buried on these grounds, but in its place has grown a new resolve to live our lives with the same grace and courage as the heroes of Flight 93. This field is now a monument to American defiance. This memorial is now a message to the world. America will never, ever submit to tyranny.
I felt like it was like the closing scene of Red Dawn, the original Red Dawn. I mean, it was movie quality.
But
obviously more important because we're talking about a real thing.
Yeah, he meant what he said, and he told their stories as if he studied their stories and what they went through.
Sandy Bradshaw, a flight attendant, called her husband and told him they were in the back of the plane preparing hot water to throw onto the hijackers. Passenger Jeremy Glick explained the plan to his wife and said, "Stay on the line, I'll be back." The passengers and crew members came together, took a vote, and they decided to act. At that moment, they took their fate and America's fate back into their own hands. In the last 20 minutes, many placed their final calls home, whispering those eternal words, "I love you."
The personal stories, the two takeaways, the personal stories, the stories of everyday heroes on that day, that should not be forgotten. And also President Trump's words, particularly his commitment to freedom and recognizing that those everyday heroes, in addition to first responders, which are everyday heroes too, in addition to American servicemen and women, this is what America is, defiance in the face of tyranny, a defiance in the face of evil, defiance in the face of fascism, which is what radical Islamism is. And so, and by the way, the willingness to call radical Islam by its name, something that our friend Dr. Zudi Jasser, the founder of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy, suggests that we need to do too, draw clear lines of moral distinction. So those are the big takeaways for me from the day, from Trump's words, and then from the ceremonies both at Shanksville, Pennsylvania, at Ground Zero, some of the footage that was re-released that had been obtained via FOIA from the government of video on the ground, journalists on the ground talking to people in real time right after the World Trade Center was struck. Just remarkable, harrowing footage. So an important day, something that even CNN had to recognize. And, you know, that's something else to mark that day, because you won't get another day like this for Trump. Poppy Harlow and David Gergen, Amy's...
Heart skipped a beat.
Yeah, Amy's crush, David Gergen, reacting just as Trump concluded his remarks yesterday morning.
Quite a tribute there to the American lives lost, murdered on 9/11 from the president speaking just now in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. David Gergen is back with me. And David, in the words of the president, they boarded that plane as strangers and they entered eternity forever linked as heroes.
Beautifully written. Very thoughtful speech by the president. I think easily one of his best speeches. For a moment, Poppy, one could almost forget the chaos around us, the acrimony, the poison, and come together.
I don't want to give you too much Gergen.
Please,
I know you're going to get overheated over there.
And that's great. I'm glad that they, you know, complimented President Trump, but didn't hear a word this morning on CNN. They didn't even show any footage. NBC News blew it off completely. ABC, CBS, all they did was show this picture of a double fist pump, Trump, when he was greeting supporters at the airport.
Well, right.
And that he was just reacting because they were standing there holding signs. They were so happy to see him. He's like, yay, you know, let's go America. And it had nothing to do with disrespecting any victim's family members from United Flight 93.
No,
but that's
not
what they choose to do. And Dan, they did not show one clip, not one soundbite of his speech.
Well,
that is disgusting.
And because they had to return. They had to return to their regularly scheduled programming, which is, you know, manufacturing hysteria surrounding Trump, get back to the authoritarian impulses narrative, get back to threat to our nation, like Scarborough's op-ed in The Washington Post suggesting that Trump is the greatest threat to America and America standing in the world.
Right.
So we had to get back to that post haste. And of course, with Hurricane Florence perhaps making landfall in the not too distant future, we have to relitigate Puerto Rican response, Hurricane Harvey response, and what this response to Florence
was. Here's the thing. I do partially blame the media, but also, too, President Trump was having a great day, a very strong presidential day. And then I think he has a brownie moment when he's talking about how successful they were in Puerto Rico. Keep in mind, this is the 17th anniversary of 9/11 when 3,000 people died. Well, 3,000 people died in Puerto Rico.
I actually think it was one of the best jobs that's ever been done with respect to what this is all about. Puerto Rico got hit not with one hurricane, but with two. And the problem with Puerto Rico is their electric grid and their electric generating plant was dead before the storms ever hit. It was in very bad shape. It was in bankruptcy, had no money. It was largely, you know, it was largely closed. And when the storm hit, they had no electricity essentially before the storm. And when the storm hit, that took it out entirely. The job that FEMA and law enforcement and everybody did working along with the governor in Puerto Rico, I think, was tremendous. I think that Puerto Rico was an incredible unsung success.
Yeah.
It was so frustrating. It's frustrating. People that I know that live in Puerto Rico had power until the hurricane hit, but I just would never have handled it that way. Say something compassionate like you did in Pennsylvania just hours before. We are sorry for the loss of life. We did the best we could. Now we have this new hurricane that could be the hurricane of a lifetime, they're saying, barreling down on us. This is what we plan to do, A, B, and C. FEMA's on the ground. Red Cross is on the way. But he didn't handle it right. I don't think so.
That's fair enough. I mean, you know, picking apart this president's off-the-cuff statements is easy to do. I've done it, too. So that's fair enough. I agree with you that that statement would have been better than calling it a success. I mean, it's, you don't want to say something is successful in the wake of that much loss of human life.
But and that's what everyone in the media focused on, well, instead of the beautiful work that he did in Shanksville, Pennsylvania.
Well, I know, but that also says something about them, too, because, again, President Trump is responsible for this once-in-100-years natural disaster in a third-world territory called Puerto Rico, which is largely a third-world territory.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, the devastation that was visited upon Puerto Rico had been visited by typhoons and in Thailand and Indonesia. And, you know, when you have countries that are...
Well, poor infrastructure and their homes are made, you know, not of, you know, sound substance.
And they don't have proper evacuation plans. Now Puerto Rico's an American territory, so you can talk about the federal government preparation for that hurricane, but there are just limitations to what the federal government can do.
And some people lost their life because they refused to leave.
The consequences it can prevent. The omnipotence of the federal government. We need, if anything, the last 2 years and the last 10 years has shown us, the last 20 years has shown us, the last 60 years has shown us, we need to get out of this way of thinking about the federal government as some omnipotent force that if we just had the right people there, if we just gave them more power and money, if we just staff them up a little bit more, if we created a new bureaucracy, we could live in a world without consequences. Very sophomoric.
If we give them El Gallito, Luis Gutierrez.
Happily.
Things will get better.
Art and McHenry.
Hello. Dan and Amy?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I wasn't sure if you got me.
You're looking for Eric
I'm
and Kathy?
Blown away by how
Eric
much...
Kathy left. Yeah.
I'm just blown away how much the liberal radio station, I'm a truck driver, and when I was listening to flipping back and forth to the liberal station yesterday, they didn't say anything or show any care for the 9/11 victims, but all they did was spend the whole day bashing Trump. And then this morning, all I'm hearing them is them bashing the way Trump was reacting and the way he acted yesterday, his speeches, his tweets. You know, that's all they got. And when it comes to Puerto Rico, you know, they'd have a lot more help if people could volunteer like they do on the mainland here. I mean, people come from all over the country in those situations to help out. When it's something like Puerto Rico, people can't come from all over the country to help them.
Yeah.
It's an accessibility issue. You know, I mean, Trump did what he could to help, but I mean, when we had this happen in Texas, people from all over the country were driving down there bringing stuff. Companies were sending truckloads of stuff.
Right.
Puerto Rico, it's different. People can't just go there.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Thanks for the call, Art. I get the logistical issue, the accessibility issue. It is an issue. I mean, you remember in Katrina. Remember in Katrina, famously, Walmart was on the scene with supplies before the federal government was. So there is, you know, there's a lot of issues. It's not so easy just to assign blame in the wake of natural disasters. By the way, you know, which we're not 100% at predicting either. You know, the prediction of the impact, not always spot on the mark, as you see with the predictions of the daily weather in Chicago. So, you know, this again, this idea of some infallibility that exists if we just have all the smart people, the best people in office. Rich and Niles. Hey, Rich.
Hello.
Yeah. You're on.
Oh, am I in the air?
Yeah, you're on. Hi, Rick.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, the reason I was calling, I listened to Mike Huckabee, and I also listened to President Trump's speech.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing irritates me more when they say, well, he's doing a great job, and I just love him, but I can't stand what he does. I can't stand his tweeting. I can't stand that. Well, I'd ask Huckabee, I'd ask any of these people that say that kind of thing, What did you accomplish that would compare to what Donald Trump has accomplished in just a year and a half as president?
Yeah.
I would like an answer to that.
I'd like to,
I'm tired of listening to Joe Walsh bitch and moan. He says, well, he's a friend of Donald Trump, but he's going to hit him in the side of the head. Well, Joe Walsh was, what, a two-year congressman? Big deal.
Thanks for the call, Rich. Appreciate it. Raquel in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey there, Dan and Amy. Hey, Amy, just wanted to just throw this out here at you. Puerto Rico, especially, I believe it was the mayor, they have a lot to be blamed for. I mean, first of all, they hired this horrible electrical company, bad infrastructure there. With all the money that we've been giving Puerto Rico, they were near bankruptcy anyway. So they were absolutely dysfunctional as government. And the next thing is that they weren't even getting the supplies to the people who needed them. It was literally just rotting in wherever it was, right, in storage.
Well,
so this isn't our federal government. This is
no question.
This has a lot to do with the dysfunction in Puerto Rico. Oh, yeah.
No question. Thanks for the call, Raquel. And you remember, too, I mean, there was the San Juan mayor's perspective. And then there was the governor of Puerto Rico, Ricardo Rossello's perspective, and he was very appreciative of the efforts by the federal government, not just the president of the United States, but all of FEMA and the response agencies, too. So, you know,
well, they weren't completely ignored this time, as they have been in the past, but this hurricane was catastrophic.
We concede the point.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate that some people choose to sort of politicize death as much as they do in this context. But, you know, there are political points to be scored, particularly on the left, it seems.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook or read about it in the paper. Hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, got a Beatles story for you, how they stuck together. But I'll hold on a second for that.
It'd be a hard story to deliver.
Just hold on to it.
Because, you know, a band that together stays together.
Mm-hmm. Mike in Big Rock, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, hi, Dan and Amy. I just want to say I'm so thankful for that older caller who just called, and he's sick and tired of people praising Trump but then saying, oh, except for this or that. You know what? Unless he commits a crime, I am not going to be apologetic for a man who's doing more for conservatism than anyone I know of. It's like people take a morally superior high ground thinking, well, you know, I wouldn't do that. It sickens me. So I just want to know, unabashedly, wear your Trump hats, your Trump shirts. Don't get in their face, but just be proud of a president who's doing something. So,
all right.
Thanks
for the call, Mike. Picking up on that, speaking about being unabashedly in your face, Paul McCartney in a recent interview in GQ.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm just gonna turn off my mic and let you explain.
What are you talking
story.
About? This is a group effort, like it was for the Beatles.
A group exercise.
Yeah,
they don't need help.
Paul McCartney, I masturbated with John Lennon once, maybe twice.
Okay, disgusting. I tried to read the article, I couldn't. But because I knew you would for me. So what happened? Just give me the cliff notes. Okay, seriously?
Come Together is an interesting choice of song. McCartney told GQ the incident happened before the Beatles got wildly famous, calling it a, quote, a one-off, or maybe it was like a two-off. They were over at John's house, maybe
at
three.
John's house? Of course they were at John's house.
Maybe three of Lennon's friends. And instead of just getting drunk and partying, we were just all in these chairs and the lights were out and somebody started masturbating. So when in John's house, we were just Bridget Bardot. Woo! And then everybody would thrash a bit more.
So.
And at one point, Lennon ruined the mood by shouting Winston Churchill.
You know what'll ruin the mood? His wife.
Did not. It sounds like Yoko was joining in.
Coming up on Chicago's Morning Answer. Okay. Now everything I say.
It's tough to transition from that, isn't it?
Yeah, but what's going on, Dan?
We're going to talk. We're going to. Seriously. I mean, that is, I think that's worse than the vomiting sound effect.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
If you're talking about it, I'll be talking about it. Dennis Prager here. Join me this morning at 11 right here on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Our colleague Dennis Prager is featured in a new film, Adam Carolla, documentary that's coming out next year, No Safe Spaces. They've got a trailer out on Facebook. YouTube, excuse me.
The university. Undoubtedly the one place where the free exchange of ideas meets with intellectual vigor and civility.
You were disgusting! Slap your racist mama!
The university is ours. Expect resistance to anyone who opposes us.
There will be resistance, and it will not be peaceful.
Free speech is free on campuses unless you're hearing ideas you don't like.
And you get the gist of it per our regular Campus Beat segment on this show. You should have a good understanding of the anti-intellectualism, intolerance, and totalitarian re-education that's going on in most college campuses in the country. Why we're pleased to be joined by Greg Lukianoff, who is the CEO of FIRE, Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. The FIRE.org is their website. He's a free speech lawyer. He's also the co-author of the new book, The Coddling of the American Mind, obviously a takeoff on Alan Bloom's magnum opus, The Closing of the American Mind. The Coddling of the American Mind is the name of the book, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. And we're pleased to be joined by the aforesaid Greg Lukianoff. Greg, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, why, since I referenced Bloom, which I think you're referencing in that title, why don't you tell us what's happened on college campuses from Alan Bloom to present?
Well, you know, I only started working on free speech issues on campus since I graduated from law school around 2000. And from about 2000 to 2013, the best constituency on campus, believe it or not, were for freedom of speech was actually the students themselves. And if you were going to get in trouble on campus, chances were it was actually going to be an administrator who decided to shut you down. But something really changed dramatically in 2013, 2014. That's when you first start hearing about, you know, microaggression policies, trigger warning policies, safe spaces. It all seemingly happened overnight. And the Coddling of the American Mind is primarily trying to figure out what on earth happened.
Well, I mean, in addition to the sort of the abridgment of free speech and the big lie that this is a, you know, the campus is a free marketplace of ideas. There's also the anti-intellectualism as it pertains to the scholarship coming out of universities, and we have this notable example that popped up last week where a respected Brown University academic is being shut down by your own school for doing research on the topic of transgenderism and the social component of transgenderism, why so many young girls have an epiphany that they're transgender. Is there a social anxiety, a social influence component? And she's not being backed up by Brown University. She's had a former dean of Harvard Medical School rally to her defense about the integrity of her research and that it calls for more research. You have anti-intellectualism at the academic level. So, of course, that's going to redound to anti-intellectualism at the student level.
Yeah, actually, two of the most harrowing chapters in the whole book are about student, outrage mobs trying to shut down professors, particularly talking about the case of Brett Weinstein at Evergreen State University. Mm-hmm. But then, much like the case you're talking about, we talk about this really horrifying case involving a professor named Rebecca Tuvel. And she wrote an academic article making the argument saying that, you know, if we can accept that people can decide their gender, why shouldn't Rachel Dolezal also, someone who decided, a white woman who decided to live her life as a black woman, why isn't that equally legitimate? And it was a thoughtful academic paper.
And in the book, and we try to be pretty calm about these issues in the book, but in the book we liken it to a genuine witch hunt, given that she was having people sign public denunciations, Professor Duvall was, of her, but then, you know, writing her behind the scenes saying, yeah, I'm really sorry what they're doing to you.
And,
wow. And so is it salvageable? I mean, Amy Wax, the University of Pennsylvania law professor who's had her own experience, which I'm sure you're familiar with, she basically says...
It's in the book.
She says the Ivy League is gone. The Ivy League is gone. Yeah. It'd be better to just decommission Ivy League schools and start over.
Yeah, I hear this fatalism, and the thing for me is that we haven't even really begun to fight these trends, because right now we're really seeing a lot of public awareness about it. And the latest phase of it, where the students themselves are the ones demanding the censorship, we really haven't seen that since, say, like the early 90s. And we haven't done even basic things like get rid of campus speech codes, or even have, you know, a session at the beginning of when people enter for orientation explaining what academic freedom is, what freedom of inquiry means. So, you know, like we've barely even begun to fight, and I think people are throwing in the towel too quick.
Do you think there's going to come a time when there's not even going to be grades distributed, just pass or fail?
Well, at some schools, there's not, and definitely when you look at grade inflation, that's arguable that at some schools that there really are still grades, given the most common grade you get at Harvard is an A.
That's right, so you might as well not have grades. Everybody wins. Here's where does this go, I guess, is the question. And so there do seem to be some encouraging signs, to address the fatalism that I started here in this conversation. Mm-hmm. Heterodox academy, academics, yep, of the left and right politically that are charting a different course, doing their own course offerings, obviously other online outlets like Khan Academy that provide, yep, coursework online. There was a Harvard, famed Harvard business professor, Clayton Christensen, Mr. Disruptive Innovation, said the other, mm-hmm, week that he predicts that in the next 10 years, half the colleges in this country will be bankrupt because the price point doesn't make any sense for the return on investment. Do you see sort of a disruptive innovation like Heterodox Academy, Khan Academy, coming online to upend the model of higher education in this country in the near term?
I mean, I think about this all the time, and I really want this to happen. At the same time, if you look at the ranking for top schools in the country and go back 100 years, it's amazing that, you know, Princeton and Harvard, you know, they're all still at the top of the list. So the top schools aren't going away anytime soon. But these big, I think there was someone who was calling them bad bet schools, essentially $60,000 a year to go to a mid-tier school, just doesn't make any sense.
Well, where do you think this is going to go from here? I mean, I don't see it getting any more liberal and progressive. But then again, nothing surprises me anymore.
Yeah, well, things are going to keep on going in one direction until they can't.
Stein's law. Yeah, right.
Exactly. I'm hopeful in some ways. I see greater public awareness of this issue. I mean, I felt like we were toiling in obscurity from 2001 to 2015, talking about how bad things were on campus already. But there's a lot more awareness of it. The problem is, of course, though, that some of these problems we're seeing, you know, they pose a long-term threat to the viability of our democracy. If you really do have universities that could be kind of making us more willing to hear the other side, and they should be making us more open-minded, actually making us more kind of like political and tribal, it can take a bad situation to make it a lot worse before it gets better.
Well, and the other thing is, and I think you're getting to this in your book as well, setting up a generation for failure, that young people are less resilient. Sarah Lipson at, yeah, Boston University had suggested that in a recent interview with the Boston Globe. You have another story out today that's really disturbing, and perhaps it goes to this issue as well. 20% of college students have weighed suicide, according to a study from Brigham and Women's Hospital. So the resiliency of students that you're trying to protect from themselves or from opinions they disagree with.
Yeah. Well, this is the scariest finding in the whole book, and definitely in researching it. Because we wrote an article called Coddling the American Mind back in 2015, basically arguing that we're teaching the generation, this generation, that the mental habits of anxious and depressed people, so we shouldn't be surprised if they're anxious and depressed. But the numbers, when they finally came out, were so much worse than we ever imagined. We are talking about of suicide for young women just between 2007 and now. The mental health situation on campuses is actually terrible. That's not just people making it up. But, you know, our argument in the book is that this is exactly what we should expect when we're teaching, you know, a generation of students that they should overgeneralize, should catastrophize, they should engage in all this bad thinking.
It seems to me one of the things that we could do as conservatives, free thinkers, is what U.S. News and World Report does. You mentioned the rankings of, you know, yeah, best schools and all that, is put out more of our own rankings on the schools you should consider if you truly do believe a college campus should be a free marketplace of ideas, and the questions you should be asking as you consider and your son or daughter considers what school they want to attend, as we sit here during sort of the application process right now for seniors.
Yeah, Heterodox Academy is trying to do exactly that, and I think that more public awareness of schools, if you actually want to have productive disagreement at a school, which schools you should go to and which schools you shouldn't. But you can also look up some of the incidents at thefire.org, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, where I'm president. We have some really horrifying tales of schools that don't respect viewpoint diversity, and some encouraging ones of schools that do.
Yeah, I think we've been doing this Campus Beat segment on this show for a few years now.
Yeah, we even have a theme song.
That's right, and I think we're down.
What's the theme song?
Oh, you want to hear it?
You want to hear it? Here.
Yeah, here it goes.
Yeah, I do.
Go, Justin, go. Our technical producer.
They got the beat, the Campus Beat, the Campus
yeah,
Beat.
Yeah, think about that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, the Campus Beat.
All right, so that'll be an earworm that you'll have to contend with the rest of the day now. But I think we're down to 6 acceptable colleges or universities you can send your kids. Maybe you have a list that we can add colleges to, but we're down to a pretty small number.
University of Chicago has been doing a good job of trying to fight back some of these trends, and that's one of them. And Princeton actually hasn't been that bad either. But definitely, you mentioned we've seen a lot of problems at Brown. Actually, DePaul University, we have no apologies about saying, is one of the worst in the country for a lot of the issues we talk about here.
Yeah, there you go. It's one of those Catholic universities that hates Catholicism. It's very curious. he is Greg Lukianoff. He's the CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Thefire.org is the website. He's also a lawyer and author of the book, The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
This is so exciting. Did you see the Cubs game?
No, but I know
on Monday
that
night.
I know they're in their full September swoon.
Yeah.
With the Brewers and the Cardinals closing.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, you love to say that. Well, Stefan Exidis, he wrote a letter to Tom Ricketts because he's been a lifelong Cub fan, has always wanted to sing the national anthem. He has Down syndrome, and he's involved in Special Olympics, and he said, look, I'll raise $5,000 if you let me sing. And the Cubs turned around and matched that. And so he raised a lot of money on Monday night singing.
Oh, can you see?
It's a lot better than Ditka.
Not bad.
How many guys?
Yeah, it's very good.
Was so excited. What makes him so awesome is that in 2005 he sang for the White Sox, and what did they do in 2005?
They won the World Series.
Yes, they did, and he was so happy to be there Monday.
Feeling really, really awesome. I'm so excited. I have practiced so many times when I had some hot tea.
All yeah, right. So he used hot tea to get ready.
Oh, well, it's just, you know, sure, got to warm up the pipes. So we got Mary Jo, Sister Mary Jo. She's going to be in our starting rotation replacing Kopech next year while he has Tommy John surgery.
Yeah.
I think the White Sox need Stefan back.
Yes.
They need more help than the Cubs do, so we need Stefan to come back to the South Side.
And it helps raise money for Special Olympics.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.